This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Amtrak has put out back in May a 76-page Amtrak corridor vision talking about what kind of growth that the commuter rail line would like to accomplish around the country. And we first talked with Steve Coxhead, who's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance, about it then. And since then, we've gotten more information out from Amtrak on topics as well as what the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance thinks as far as a wish list is concerned. And Steve Coxhead's back with us to talk about it today. Steve, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
What's an interesting 76-page report that came out back in May from Amtrak to try to tell more people about the vision that they have over the next 15 years. Will you recap a little of it for us, and certainly about the impact that the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance feels will have on the Hoosier State?
Well, basically, what Amtrak is proposing, you know, providing to have appropriate funding, is to expand service nationwide. They're talking about adding routes and adding the number of trains, or as we say, the number of frequencies on existing routes. Many of the things they have talked about are things that the passenger rail advocacy community has wanted, and many communities have wanted for many years. Among them, they've talked about increasing the number of daily trains across northern Indiana from Chicago into Detroit and Toledo and on to New York. They have talked about basically increasing the number of trains on the Chicago-Indianapolis-Cincinnati corridor to four or five trains a day, which is something that we've wanted and many have wanted for a long time. And they've also included a leg from Indianapolis to Louisville. So if the if Amtrak's plans as regard Indiana were to actually materialize, we would have vastly improved service across the northern part of the state and diagonally linking northwest Indiana with Indianapolis and Cincinnati and Louisville, which would be better service than probably we've seen in, since the 50s or 60s. Now, there's a couple catches there. One, as far as we know, Amtrak has not made any definite or binding commitments, okay? That is to say, they have not come out publicly and said, if we get so much money, we will do this on this schedule. Mm-hmm. What they have is more or less a conceptual plan, which we applaud. The other problem is that it relies on federal appropriations. There is a large new federal infrastructure bill making its way through Congress, I think actively in the Senate now, which would provide a lot more money available for passenger rail, public transit, and specifically for Amtrak. So Amtrak's ability to be able to carry out any part of its plans would depend to a large extent on this infrastructure bill or one like it being passed in the near future. Now, a further problem, and this was in, I was looking at my local paper this morning, and both of our Indiana senators, Senator Young and Senator Braun, have announced already that they're going to vote against the infrastructure bill that's currently before the Senate. Mm-hmm. Our organization actually has sent letters to both senators earlier indicating that while not wishing to pass judgment on the infrastructure bill as a whole or, you know, what would be appropriate, inappropriate, that they should seriously consider voting in favor of spending that would benefit Indiana. You know, obviously Amtrak's conceptual vision would benefit Indiana if the if they get funding from this infrastructure bill or one like it. So we've got a good plan from Amtrak, but it's not a done deal yet. We have to have the money allocated, and frankly, without being partisan at all, I'll say we need to get our Indiana senators on board, or at least on board to something that would provide funding for developments in Indiana. And it probably would not hurt for people to get a hold of their congressman, too, because we have to remember whatever infrastructure bill comes out of the Senate has to go right back to a conference committee and then back to the House, where there will be another vote. So while we're optimistic about Amtrak's announcements and plans, we hope people realize that there's a lot of hard work yet to go before that can be realized.
I know that a lot of these points that you've just brought up here are included in the overall view, the long-range plan that the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance has, and you actually spent time in recent days to put out, I guess, an editorial to give it in much more detail. You mentioned some things already. Are there more things that the Alliance would like to see done, at least as far as the long-range plan is concerned?
Well, there's a very critical thing, and this is one thing the Alliance is doing now. We're working with a sister organization, the Northeastern Indiana Passenger Rail Association, and we've been in talks with some of our members of the General Assembly and NDOT staffers. We hope to have a bill submitted to the next session of the General Assembly, which would establish what we hope will be called the Indiana Passenger Rail Commission. That would provide a formal structure to involve NDOT, the rail advocacy organizations, and we hope at some point NICTD, in a process of planning and pushing forward rail developments that would be important to Indiana. Now, to your point, Chris, right now Indiana really has no plans to put forward. Let's say an infrastructure bill does pass at some point.
Okay.
In order to get that federal money, the states, usually the state DOTs, have to put forward a plan and a request. We're hoping that if we get this passenger rail commission up and running, that it will provide a nonpartisan way of nudging, shall we say, the DOT to the point where it actually has plans and proposals on the table. So as federal funding money becomes available, requests can be made. And I think that would probably be the most important long-term issue right now, because right now, as it stands, Indiana is really not set up to request funding if funding becomes available. Okay. So in the deep background, we have to get the federal funding available. But closer to home, what we don't have and what the Passenger Rail Alliance is trying to position us to do is get the state in a position where, as funding becomes available, we have well thought out plans ready to go, things that we could actually make a request from the Federal Department of Transportation or the FRA or whatever. Mm-hmm. As an example, actually back in 2019, NDOT commissioned a study which looked at the Indianapolis-Dyer, Indiana corridor and said, well, okay, what would it take to improve that corridor so we could support two or three round trips a day on speeds running, averaging 80 miles an hour? And we have a number attached to it, okay? I think the number is roughly $700 million. These are all improvements to what's mainly a CSX right-of-way. As far as we know, no one is planning to actually go to the feds and request funding for any part of that, okay? So it just kind of sits in limbo. You have a similar situation. We have the Northern Indiana Project, which would link Chicago through Gary and on into Fort Wayne and eventually to Lima, Ohio. It requires preliminary studies, engineering studies, environmental studies, before it could move forward. We really need to have the state of Indiana, through NDOT, make requests for funding, as money becomes available. And I concentrate on federal funding because, the amounts of money involved are very large, and traditionally transportation projects, highways, airports, and so forth, have relied on federal funding, as does for a good part the South Shore expansion. So I would say, in terms of long-range planning, we really need to get the state of Indiana to the point where it has plans and it has requests ready to go. Well, what does that mean for the listener? Well, everyone's represented by a state senator and a state representative. Everyone's represented by our governor. I would say people that are concerned with this issue really need to talk with the governor's office and get a hold of their local state senator and state representative, because it's a state issue. We have to have the state of Indiana, you know, initiate something. So in terms of long-range planning, you know, I would say that that would be what our organization would urge people to do. You know, now if the state of Indiana would put together some plans that were consistent with Amtrak's proposals and if funding were to become available, then basically what Amtrak has been talking about would be, you know, it would be wonderful, actually. I use the term wonderful. I'm not sure if anyone is thinking where we go beyond that. Now, if you want to look over the horizon, and no one is suggesting this right now because of the cost, the route across northern Indiana and the Chicago, Indianapolis, Cincinnati route, which Amtrak has included in their plan, many years ago, those were designated by the federal government as high-speed rail corridors, which means that the government had determined that if we were to build true high-speed rail, which would run, let's say, at 200 miles an hour, that those would be the two routes that would be appropriate through Indiana. So if you're looking at the over-the-horizon future, you know, that would be where we would want to aim for, to put Indianapolis, let's say, within an hour and a half of downtown Chicago would probably be a game-changer in many ways. You know, however, because of the cost, I mean, you look at there's a project like that is underway in California, and we're talking about billions, with a B, billions of dollars. And I don't think anyone is talking about having that much either state or federal funds available, you know, for anywhere in the Midwest. But, you know, if you want a long-term goal, you know, you could look at that. In the short and the intermediate goal, we've got to get state-of-the-art systems running. You know, which is on the corridors that I've talked about, and you could easily run trains up to 100 miles an hour with existing technology, with existing infrastructure. We know how to do that. We were doing it in the 40s and 50s, in fact. So it's a phased-in approach. You know, we have to get the state of Indiana to the point where it has proposals ready to put forward, and we have to get state-of-the-art rail. And then we have to move on to something better than that. My long editorial in our newsletter that came out recently addressed the fact that often when we talk about planning, people look at the Hoosier State, the Cardinal, and say, well, it takes too long to get to Chicago. It's often, you know, it doesn't keep the schedule. You know, it doesn't have Wi-Fi. It doesn't have this. And what I wanted to do is basically stop that conversation and say, look, we know what Amtrak provided us with in the past. That's not what we want. We want something better. Basically, we think Indiana deserves something similar to what you see on the Northeast Corridor. And I would consider that first-class service and that corridor between Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C. You know, service of that type, I think, is justified and frankly, deserved in the Midwest and particularly in Indiana. So that was the gist of that editorial, that, you know, let's stop worrying over, you know, the flaws of what Amtrak may have, you know, given us in the past, and let's concentrate on what we actually need as we go forward into the 21st century.
So it sounds like that certainly that the Alliance feels that the first important thing is certainly to get public support and lobby with the members of Congress to make sure that the infrastructure funding is there, as well as working with lawmakers on this bill that you say is going to be introduced next session to set up the Indiana Passenger Rail Commission. And that commission, it sounds like, could be the go-between, maybe between NDOT and some of the state agencies and the federal government to encourage the federal funds to come in and make all these improvements that need to be made.
Yeah, we hope there's synergy there. You know, NDOT, of course, you know, is a state executive agency. The Passenger Rail Alliance is a nonprofit 501(c). The Northeastern Indiana Passenger Rail Association is not a 501(c). It's a different kind of organization. The three organizations are each legally capable of doing different things. And we hope that would be complementary, so that the combination of the organizations working together would be synergistic, you know, would provide good things.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a measure that will come up hopefully in the next General Assembly session and bring up some more discussion and I'm sure a lot of comment as well. And Steve, thank you for spending time going over what the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance has planned for the long term and as well as what Amtrak is thinking about as well, too. Thanks for spending time with us, and we'll certainly talk again on the subject, and especially as we get close to another General Assembly session. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Take
You're
care.
You're welcome. You too. Take care. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Everyday patients with chronic illnesses need blood transfusions. But what if the blood bank doesn't have a match? Side Effects Public Media's Farah Yousry reports that some African-American patients will have to wait for days.
Letitia Bryan's friends know her as the life of the party.
I have a lot of friends. I do. And they all say that. You're crazy. Like, it's just... But I just like to have fun.
She's 48. She has a pink pixie haircut. She's bedazzled with hoop earrings and colorful charm bracelets on her left wrist. The right wrist still has a hospital bracelet. She just came back from an appointment.
I'm a person that has sickle cell anemia.
Which means her red blood cells are misshapen and are more likely to clot. She's more prone to stroke and organ failure. So Bryant needs blood transfusions a few times a year. But finding the blood can be a challenge.
When you're already hurting and in pain, that makes you be uneasy because you don't want to even think or, you know, have a situation where you can't get blood. And then knowing that you will be sicker and sicker as time goes.
Bryant does not have a blood match in Indiana. And that's mainly because she's African-American. She's also far from the only one who needs a match. Kimber Blackwell, a physician assistant at the Indiana Hemophilia and Thrombosis Center, says the center has several patients who also don't have a match.
So when I see them get admitted, I start to get nervous because I know if this person needs blood, it's going to take us 2 days to get blood from a blood bank out of state to match up with them.
And 2 days is too long.
And 2 days can be too long, yeah.
She says there's a shortage in African-American blood and stem cell donors. In fact, the Red Cross says only 3% of blood donors are African-American. And that's a big problem.
So when we think of blood typing, we think of everybody being type A, type O, type AB, or type B, and then positive or negative on top of that. But then there's these minor antigens that are on the surface of the red cell.
These antigens are made of proteins and sugars, and they come in many different combinations. They differ from one person to another and from one ethnicity to another. So, a black patient will likely find a better match in a pool of black donors. And that's especially crucial for patients who get frequent blood transfusions, like those with certain blood cancers or sickle cell disease. Because if they don't...
Then the body can have a reaction to fight it. And that can actually make the blood cells get destroyed.
And Blackwell says that would make it even harder for some patients to receive transfusions in the future, especially with the ongoing shortage of black blood donors. This shortage has its reasons. Lack of awareness is a big one. But Amrita Myers, professor of gender and African-American history at IU Bloomington, says there's also a lack of trust in the medical establishment. Blood donation and banking are tainted with a racist past.
And so even though a black doctor had helped to create the technology for blood preservation for banking purposes, there were people who didn't want a white person's donated blood going into a black person's body and vice versa. The banked blood was being kept segregated.
The Red Cross labeled blood from black donors as Negro blood back then, not based on science, but out of racism. Some black Americans were even turned away from donating blood during events like World War II and Pearl Harbor.
Please avoid excessive heavy bending, lifting, pushing, or pulling with this arm because it could result in a bruise, okay?
Okay. Blood donation booths like this one at the Indiana Black Expo is one way some blood centers are trying to raise awareness and build trust. The booth belongs to Versity Blood Center, and it's staffed with an all-black nurse and technician crew.
Do you have a band-aid that you want to...
Just keep the pressure on
them. Oh, okay.
Adam Richardson is scared of needles. He doesn't usually donate blood, yet somehow he sits at this booth with a needle in his arm. He's African American, and he sees there's only one other person donating, a Caucasian man.
You know, I would have felt bad if they only have one or two, you know, I mean.
He waits as a half-liter bag is filled with his blood and is assured by what the nurse tells him that his donation will help save lives. Farah Yusri, Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Month of August is National Eye Exam and Children's Eye Health Care Month, a very important time, especially as youngsters are getting ready to go back to school, many of them going back to school in person, as opposed to where we were about this time last year because of the pandemic. With us to find out more about the importance of eye exams for taking care of young people as they get back to learning, we have Katie Overby, who is the OneSight President and Executive Director of this Global Vision nonprofit, which has, by the way, a clinic in Gary. And Katie, thank you for joining us on the program today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Why is it so important to have a National Eye Exam and Child's Eye Health Month?
Well, you know, as you said, this month is a big time for people to get their eyes checked, and it's really important to shine a light on eye health for both adults and children.
What seem to be the best ways that not only we as adults, but youngsters can protect their vision and just in general, the parents can protect their youngsters' vision?
Well, I would say the number one most important thing is to really get regular comprehensive eye exams. That's important for children as well as adults. And, you know, if people say that's hard to do right now, I can't afford it, there are numerous resources to turn to for help. In fact, we are one of them. You can find information on our website at www.onesight.org/get-help.
And there are also some opportunities, too, that you folks with One Vision have, as we mentioned earlier in our conversation, here in Northwest Indiana, so that if young people and their family members need to go in for eye exams, you can't afford them, you get some help along the way.
That's right. We do have a permanent center based in Gary. Again, our website, onesight.org, would have more information. And we also were recently in the south side of Chicago, actually providing care to the community there. Mm-hmm. So we really try to make sure that for anyone who is lacking access to quality vision care and eyeglasses, we make sure that they get them.
Well, it's very important not only for adults but youngsters to at least have some idea of why they need to come in for eye exams, and for family members to be able to keep close track of what the exams prove, what kind of things that they may discover in the exams that the young, especially youngsters, have to take care of, or family members have to take care of. Will you tell us a little bit more about the importance of knowing your family's eye health history?
Absolutely. You know, knowing your family's eye health history, knowing if anybody's ever been diagnosed with an eye disease or a condition, you know, you can watch for it. Some of those things are hereditary. And it's so important to take care of it because, as you mentioned, kids are going back to school. It has a direct impact on their ability to learn. We know that one in four school children in the U.S. has an undiagnosed vision problem. And, you know, Chris, children learn twice as much with clear vision versus when they're struggling to see the board. And again, for adults, it's the same thing. You know, we know that adults are 35% more productive with clear vision. So for everyone, it's just really important to stay on top of it.
This is why it's so important to wear protective eye care for adults as well as youngsters, but particularly for young people because their eyes are still growing, aren't they?
Absolutely. And you know, especially in this past year, you know, everybody's been looking at screens. That can lead to eye exhaustion. Right now, it's summertime. Everybody should wear sunglasses that can hopefully block almost all of the UVA and UVB rays. Just everything you can do to try to protect and preserve that eye health.
I know in the past we've talked about OneSight, about not only the center that's set up in Gary to help people that may need help with eye health care, can't afford to go to the regular eye care centers for the help they get. And it's also important, too, I guess, for grown-ups to be able to get the help they need as well when they have to go in the workplace to make sure that if they're outdoors or if they're in some industrial setting, to be sure they have proper eye care.
Absolutely. It's important for everyone.
If anybody would have any questions, where's the website address that they can go to? And if they in particular like to know about the clinic set up in Gary.
Mm-hmm. So our website is www.onesight.org. That's onesight.org. And like I said, if someone is particularly looking for resources for themselves, look on www.onesight.org/get-help.
Mm-hmm. K.T. Overby is the president and executive director of OneSight, which is the Global Vision nonprofit. And K.T., thank you for joining us, and great advice for adults as well as children who need to be prepared to better care for their eyes, and especially for young people getting ready to go to school this fall. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
The American Rescue Plan allocated $17 billion to support veterans affected by the COVID-19 pandemic with some badly needed funds. The acting secretary for benefits with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, Tom Murphy, was with us to talk about how the changes can transform Hoosier veterans' lives. And he begins the conversation with a look at changes that are being made by the American Rescue Plan to veterans' current benefits.
There's a targeted part of the law called the Veterans Rapid Retraining Assistance Program. This is $386 million that provides for training and employment assistance services for veterans that lost their job as a result of COVID.
Does the new law offer any new benefits since we've talked about the present ones?
Oh, the VRAP one is the one that's impacted here. This is a great new benefit.
Mm-hmm.
It gives 12 months of training for a new targeted position. It pays the tuition, it pays the fees, it provides a monthly housing allowance in the form of a stipend for the veteran while they're completing that program. It's targeted to veterans that are between the age of 22 and 67 years old, and it's got a limiting factor, and the factor is its high demand occupation list as defined by the Department of Labor.
When you talk about high-demand jobs that makes available for unemployed veterans, any ones in particular that you can bring out, or is there a whole gamut of them that might be affected?
I was rather surprised when I saw the list. It really is a gamut, and it's the jobs that drive our economy. It can be in the trades, it could be truck driving, it could be computer programming, it can be in the business world or teaching. You really got to go take at the list and see just how broad and wide this is. So what VA did is we lined up institutions that provide training that meet the needs of that high-demand occupation list. We send the veteran to school, like I said, up to 12 months, pay all the fees, tuitions, et cetera, and at the end of it comes the best part. It's got job placement services to come along with it.
Now, we know that the GI Bill has gone through a lot of changes, a lot of transformations from its original days following World War II and the Vietnam-era veterans and the Vietnam War veterans that have been able to take advantage of it. And now, of course, post-Vietnam with some of the newer versions of the GI Bill. What kind of benefits are going to be taken care of with this new program that's going to be coming up here? I hear something like it's called a 90-10 loophole. What is that, and how are the changes going to be affected in that?
The 90-10 loophole is about ensuring that the veterans that use their very precious GI Bill benefits are used on a quality education that's going to do something good for the veteran. So there has to be a number of students and the revenue that comes into an institution from other than just veterans by themselves. And in this way, we ensure that it's not something that's just simply targeted as a mill to do for veterans. It adds true value and really makes the veteran's life better in the end. So the 90-10 rule helps protect veterans in that way.
Mm-hmm. Have there been a lot of problems? There have been obviously enough of them noted over the years that you had to make some changes to close that loophole. What types of things have been documented that veterans have noted to the VA about the problems that maybe they had in their education benefits?
Look, we're a very large organization. We have a really broad application in the higher level, higher learning institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's always things that don't go the way you want. So as we work with the IG, as we work with GAO, as we work with others, as we hear from veterans, we find out things that, hey, this really isn't working the way we need it to be. And then we go back in and change the rules to ensure that, number one, the funds are being expended the way Congress intended it to be, and number two, that veterans aren't being taken care of and that they're getting a really value-add quality education.
We're talking with Tom Murphy. He's the acting undersecretary for benefits for the Department of Veterans Affairs in Washington. And we've been talking about some big changes that have come about as a result of the American Rescue Plan of 2021. We've talked about educational benefits. We've talked about retraining benefits for veterans who need to look into a new career of some kind or another. Are there any other benefits that have made some big changes that are going to really affect veterans' lives we haven't mentioned?
Yeah, there's a really big one here. VA made a giant change in the way we processed when the COVID hit. We shut down our clinics, we stopped taking veterans in, and we reopened them to in-person examinations for medical examinations resulting from a claim that a veteran filed with the VA. In October, we opened up the in-person examinations again, and we've expanded that capability and continue to do so. We've also expanded the capability to get those examinations done inside of VHA. So the driver today for workforce to get decisions done out of the VA is veterans showing up to get their examinations done. So here's what's happened in the meantime. We set it up so it's a safe environment. We set it up with scheduling so that we don't have veterans in a waiting room together. There's distancing. We're sterilizing and cleaning in between appointments. And we're lining up the veterans one after another to come in. The veterans are now largely vaccinated. If they don't, they have the option to come in to VA. We'll vaccinate the veteran, we'll vaccinate their spouse, and we'll vaccinate their caregivers. Then come in, get your medical examinations done, and we have people ready to work those claims as soon as the medical examinations are done. So what can you do today to help speed the process? Contact the person that called you and said, I'm ready to take my medical examination now.
Sounds almost too simple. There must be some paperwork or something that be involved here. And certainly you have to apply for some of the opportunities. When can veterans apply for this program?
Well, the VRAP program, you can call us at 1-800-MY-VA-411. Mm-hmm. You can come to our website, benefits.va.gov, or if you want, contact your local veteran service officer, who will do those things for you and help you get into this program.
That's great. Now, if anybody is not aware, who is eligible for these opportunities?
This is targeted at veterans for 22 that are aged 22 to 67 years old and have lost their job as a result of COVID. Now, if you're already in school today going to the GI Bill, you're not eligible. Mm-hmm. If you are already today going through a program with our VR&E program, then you're not eligible. So this is targeted at the veteran that has no other options, that has lost their job and is financially impacted by the virus.
Once again, interested veterans can call the VA at 1-800-698-2411. That's 800-MY-VA-411 for more details. COVID-19 is already disrupting the new school year for some students around the Hoosier State. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports that it's creating challenges for schools hoping to keep kids in classrooms, especially in the elementary grades.
Some Hoosier schools are already pulling kids from class to quarantine, including in Anderson Community Schools. Madison County Health Department's Administrator Stephanie Mellinger says, with cases rising and a mix of approaches for the return to school buildings, it feels similar to this time last year.
Our case rate and our positivity rate is even higher than it was last year when we started.
But there are key differences. According to the state, unvaccinated people in schools have to be quarantined if they're a close contact of a COVID-positive person. That means all elementary-age kids are subject to the 8-day minimum. On the other hand, vaccinated individuals don't have to quarantine if they don't show symptoms. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
There's money coming into Lake County for renters and landlords and homeowners who need help in trying to deal with the eviction and foreclosure issues that are happening and maybe forthcoming more so in the region because of changes on the federal level. To find out more about the funds that are available, Tim Brown is with us. He's Executive Director of the Lake County Community Economic Development Department. Tim, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you very much.
Will you tell us a little bit about the funds that are available to Lake County to be able to use this way to help family members as well as landlords out if they need the help?
Yeah, sure. Back a few months ago with the federal legislation that did the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, it started in December and January of last year and then this year, we ended up getting in Lake County $14.5 million. $13 million of that is for renters to handle back rent and some cases future rent and also utilities, whether that be NIPSCO, water, sewer, and internet if it's school-related or job-related. And of that, we've spent approximately $7.2 million of the $13 million. We're required to spend $8.6 million of it by the end of September. In fact, we'll easily meet that goal. Last week, we did a check run of over $1
million. Wow.
Yeah, it's working out real well. We're just trying to make sure. We kind of panicked when the moratorium stopped last Saturday evening without an extension. I've been trying to get as much of the word out as I can that we have these funds still available. In fact, the state of Indiana is going to allow us to access some of their funds that they have left over so we can actually enhance the program even better and have more funds available even than the original $13 million for clients. This is only for renters. It's not for mortgage holders. Mortgage holders, if you have an FHA mortgage, you can kind of contact FHA, and they have a program available to give you some extensions and some changes to your mortgage agreements. The state of Indiana is coming out with a mortgage program here probably by the end of this month, and that would be through what we call IHCDA as the acronym, but that's the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority. Mm-hmm. And they actually have a website set up right now. And if I recall correctly, it's www.inhope.gov. And you can go and put a place marker. If you're having need to get mortgage assistance, you can put your information in there. And once that program is up and running, they will contact you.
Now, I understand you have several partners within the program, not just the Lake County Community Economic Development Department, but some community partners that are helping with this program in particular, the one for renters, that is.
Yes, that's correct. We went through a process back in February to select an administrator for the program, and we ended up selecting Geminis Corporation that's out of Merrillville. We had used them in the past. Some years ago, during the Great Recession, we used their agency for what we call a rapid rehousing program that was sponsored by the Obama administration at the time. In this particular case, they already have a basic setup. They do an awful lot of other federal-funded programs, and they had the core group. They had Catholic Charities, United Way, already in the queue to be able to help with assistance. So it was a lot easier to get this thing spun up and running. They also had Salvation Army assistance that they've used in the past. And they had the biggest connection, which was a connection with NIPSCO, because they had already been doing utility assistance for some time in other programs. So getting that component started up and working well was very easy from the very beginning. The hardest part has been getting the computer program. We use a program now called Submittables, because they were not using that program at the time. But we're using a program called Submittables, which is the same program that the state of Indiana is using. And we did that for a reason, so that you don't have this problem of assistance being overlapped from one program to the next. Because that, the Treasury said very specifically, you can't assist somebody twice for the same time period of assistance.
If you will, go again and what you've mentioned so far, Tim, and refresh our memories and let people know if they have questions, if they have concerns, if they actually do need some emergency rental assistance, where do they need to go, especially if they live here in Lake County, to be able to get things started so they can get the help they need as soon as they possibly can.
Yeah, the best thing to do is to go to www.lakecountyin.care. Everything is online. Everything is computer generated. All you have to do is get on that system, fill out the basic forms, then supply the data like a lease and utility bills and so on. I mean, you have to fill in some of the gaps for information purposes, and that gets you started with the program to get rental assistance. And it can go back, that rental assistance can go back to March of 2020.
Wow.
So you know, we're averaging about $6,300 per client, and that's just the average. And we've done well over 1,300 clients so far. And we expect a lot more interest, especially since the evictions are being lifted. We expect a lot more interest in this program. We want people to come in and use it, because we need to get these monies out the door. I mean, that's just the plain, you know, basic truth of it. The reason is not only to help renters, but it is to help landlords get whole, too. That was a big part of all this, so that they got their money so that they can do their maintenance, their, you know, pay their taxes, do the things that they need to do as a landlord.
Tim Brown is executive director of the Lake County Community Economic Development Department. He's been telling us about the opportunity out there now to get assistance to be able to alleviate evictions and foreclosure notices that are happening and may continue to happen here in the region. And Tim, thank you very much for the information. Hope people go online. If they have the questions, they can find out more and get started so they can get the help they need. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.